Hey everyone, it's Adam from the podcast, and today we have a very special, unique episode. We are coming to you live from the Dallas Comedy Club in Deep Ellum, Dallas, Texas. We did a live podcast recording there during our weekend of workshops and shows, interviewed by the incredibly funny improviser, Corey Whaley. So give it a listen, and we will see you back with the regular pod next week. Bye!
This big warm-up.
Oh my God, we're going to talk improv.
All right, let's do it.
Hello and welcome back to the Dallas Comedy Club podcast. I'm your host, Corey Whaley, sitting in for Kimberly Alou. And today I'm sitting down with the award-winning, always insightful, very talented hosts of the Backline podcast. They are Adam Cauley, alumnus of the Second City main stage, and Rob Norman, author of the cool improv book, Improvising Now, A Practical Guide to Modern Improv. Adam and Rob, welcome. Woo!
We've been doing the podcast for maybe 6-7 years, and that's the first time we've heard someone else do our intro. We love it.
I mean, I love that intro. I've heard it over and over again. So I was like, I'm going to say that intro, and it's something I get to check off my bucket list now.
You nailed it. Well, we're very, very professional. Excited to be here. Thank you, Corey.
So not just welcome here, but welcome to Dallas.
Woo.
So glad that you came down. And it's your very first time. So what do you think so far? I know your weekend is just starting.
Yeah, so far where Dallas Comedy Club is in Deep Ellum. Mm-hmm. Pronouncing that right?
Yep.
Maybe the coolest neighborhood I've ever been in.
I would say it's the coolest neighborhood in Dallas. That's
that's what I would say. We've been, this is the place I want. I was like, we don't need to go anywhere else. This is the place. It felt like there's a place where in Toronto called Kensington Market, which is very much like that. In L.A., it feels like Venice Beach that you've just taken and kind of caved in on itself. But it's like amazing art, amazing restaurants. Yeah, we're very happy.
Very good vibe.
Very good vibe.
Very good vibe, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Now, you were saying that you've been doing your podcast now for like 6 years or so, which is great. How do you keep that going? Like what keeps that interesting and alive for you?
Yeah. So, Adam, what's that like for you? How do you manage to edit it, record it, like for 6 years?
I think what Corey is more interested in is the topic. So I can speak to that because you're more the technical person. Okay. I'm more the creative person. I honestly, the reason we're here and the reason we go anywhere is because of the podcast. And so coming from a city like Toronto originally, where there's a ton of improv history, to talk about what affects us and then hear from people around the world where it's like, hey, what's going on in Oslo? And people in Oslo write and it's like, hey, here's what we're dealing with. And I'm like, oh my God, I didn't even think about that. So I think the world and the different communities that we've been able to reach out to have really helped us with our topics and keeping it going, because every city in the world is at a different improv evolution stage. And so to be like, I know where you are. That's where Toronto was in 1989, or that's where Chicago was in this year. And so I think the global community has really helped the idea of topics becoming very easy.
Yeah, and I think improv is growing and it is changing. Like, we've really only been around since the 1950s, so this is a very new art form, and we haven't quite figured out where the edges of improv are yet. So it's not like we've run out of things to say, because things are changing so frequently within improv. I mean, even for us, when we started, our teacher taught us that when we started an improv scene, Corey, you would start with object work, I would join you on stage, then I would tell you what you were doing, where you were doing it, where what both of our characters' names were, and what was about to happen in the scene. I would never think of starting a scene that way. That's an insane way to start a scene.
That's a lot of information
at
once.
It's too much information, but that was the status quo. And even in our short, brief improv lives, we've watched a city go from a bankrupt Second City, no theater sports, other spaces closing down, to a thriving hub of our country, the kind of premier place where you would want to improvise. That's all happened in our short improv career. So things are always fluid and changing within improv.
Now, to get an idea of like your whole journey to where you are now, what, for both of you, What would you say is your earliest memory of like comedy, just in general?
Can you Mine remember? Was Robin Williams as the genie in Aladdin, and I would do he would do impressions of like Rodney Dangerfield and Jack Nicholson as the genie, and so I would do impressions as the genie as Rodney Dangerfield, a person I did not know who he was. And I would do it in front of my family, and my family would be like, "That's great!" And I was like, "I guess this is what I have to do." And so it all started with playing chess with the flying carpet, and he loses, and then he does a Roger Dangerfield impression, and that's where it started. That's where
so
it all
that
started.
Was the moment for you.
That was the moment that I can remember of like, "Oh, that's gotcha. That's when I first really like saw comedy and said, what if I did that?' And then I did it, and then received praise." Yeah,
you wow. stole someone else's joke, and then you were like, "That's how you do comedy."
Impressions is stealing someone else's joke, and so I right. did it. I did what Robin Williams did to Rodney Dangerfield, but I did it.
So was it an impression of Rodney Dangerfield, or was it an impression of Robin Williams doing an impression of Rodney Dangerfield?
The latter
that one.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
I mean, my story is the exact same, except I was in grade 4 and doing an impression of Dave Coulier doing an impression of Popeye.
There you go. There you go.
Way less cool of a story than yours.
You said Dave Coulier, and I was trying to figure out where that was going to go, because I'm not that familiar. I mean, outside of Full House, that's all I know. But
America's Funniest People?
Uh-huh. Boyfriend to Alanis Morissette?
Oh, yes. So, of course.
I mean, Corey, get it together. Get it together.
All right. So, well, for other people that are pursuing comedy then, do you have something that, because you have to be asked this all the time, I would imagine, like, what is the piece of advice that people ask for, or what do you say is like the biggest piece of advice if people want to, you know, go into comedy, follow in your footsteps even?
I think there's two probably different people or two vibes. One is, how do I make it? And the other person being like, how do I get good at this? And so I think those require two different answers. But usually the person who's like, how do I make it? You're just like, you should just avoid this. If that's the mindset going in, like, you're going to be crushed the entire time. So just be aware that going for making it, whatever that means, it's going to crush you. But then the kind of like the person who says, how do I get good? Then it's just a more nuanced answer of, we start to break it down. What do you like? Are you excited about something you've seen? Usually they saw stand-up or Whose Line or Kids in the Hall, and you're like, oh, I really gravitate toward one of those. And then we just go real basic into like, well, here's how you can do this. Here's the training center, or here's a bar you can rent with your friends and just put up whatever you like, low stakes. So those are kind of the things that we would normally start with.
I like in the first example, when you're talking about making it in improv, and I like the idea that it is $10,000 a year.
Oh,
I made it. $10,000 a year. That's my career. And I mean, I think if you have reasonable goals, then improv is a very attainable thing, because improv is all about community, and communities want people to be a part of it. I think the challenges are when you say, hey, I want to be at this level, or I want to be in this show, or I want to get paid by this company, you know, that really just an investment of time. Because I got this advice very early on. A very seasoned improviser said to me, I was like, how do I get where you are? And he said, the answer is, just wait around long enough. Either you will be the best person left, or the people who are better than you will have already been hired, and eventually they'll need someone to replace them. And he wasn't wrong. Like, that's exactly what happens within your improv community. People move on, or they quit. Then it's just you.
I think people make fun of improv, of like, oh, it's like a cult, or like you get addicted to it. And I think you do. And so it's a difficult position to be in when you're like, I want it all now. And it's like showing up to your first day of college saying, I want the information of 4 years now. And it's hard to say to someone, you need to take the 4 years to do it, you know? That's all.
Or like 6 years.
6 years, depending.
Depending on who it is. Yeah.
I would say that Yeah, you do have to put the time in mainly because of the, what is it called? The
rejection.
What is that crap?
Oh.
Is it the Krunning-Duger effect? I'm going to mess that up. Yes, thank you. Dunning-Kruger effect. I could not think of what that was.
What is this? Tell
thank
me.
Thank you, Ian. It's this theory about when you start learning something new and you start learning those first few things about it, you immediately think, ah, I got it. I know what I'm doing. And then as you continue to learn, you start realizing, oh, wait, I don't know as much as I thought I did. I'm horrible at this. I really need to know more about it. And then you slowly work up to, you know, some kind of skill level with that.
Yeah, I think there's something about humility in that. That effect, because I think it's also about if you think you get a test and you think you're going to do really well on that test, it's more likely that you're going to do worse on that test. But if you think you're going to do badly on the test, it's more likely that you'll do better than what you thought. Hmm. So you enter into a space. If you think you're smart, then you're probably less smart than you actually are. Yeah.
Kind of on that note, what do you think about the idea that as we learn more about improv or any art form, the more we learn about it, the more like refined our tastes are, I guess is one way to say it, mm-hmm. and wanting to get there, but knowing that we're not. Hmm. How do you, have you experienced that yourselves?
Yeah, like, I mean, the more you learn, I think it can be mistaken as judgment, but it's really just like for me, like musical improv. I recognize musical improv as something that people really enjoy, that people love doing, and people love watching. I have no interest in musical improv, but I recognize it requires a lot of skill. It just doesn't interest me at all. And so that just came from watching a bunch, doing it a little, and then saying, no. And so there's nothing, it might come across as like, oh, he hates it. And it's just like, no, I think it's great. I just don't enjoy it myself, so I don't do it and I don't go and watch it, and I think that's an exciting place to be, because it's like you're going through your improv puberty of you're just learning more about yourself and then saying, oh, I used to be ashamed of this, or I used to feel awkward about this, and then you get to a certain point where you're just like, oh no, this is who I am. And that's okay, and I like that.
Yeah, and I think you're kind of talking about like the personal place of your own taste. Is that what you're talking about there, AC? I think there's also this other element, which is the larger scale. Like, you know, for Adam and I coming up, it was a time when Second City had gone bankrupt. There's a Second City Toronto, which was our major theater. It's also where we did most of our training. And so also for us, it meant that when Second City closed down, all of the improvisers were gone. All the people that were good probably were on a Canadian TV show. They were probably like busy doing Degrassi or something. And so Adam and I were just kind of abandoned in our formative years, and there was no one to teach us how to do this. And so our solution was just make it up. Like, if you don't know what Game of the Scene is, do a show, talk to your friends about it, and then figure it out. And that's most of the foundation of Toronto. We have a lot of different ideas because we were so far from places like UCB and what was happening in Chicago, even a place like Calgary, which has very clear rules from Keith Johnstone. And I think that was one of our greatest advantages, because we had no one to instruct us on how to do it, we kind of had to make up the rules. And as we tour more and more, we go to places like, we were just talking about backstage, about like Norway and Denmark. These are places that are so far removed from the mothership. They're reinventing improv without even knowing that they're doing it. And it's a very exciting place for you to be. So I feel like sometimes knowing less can also be an advantage in a weird way. If you're trying to build your own style, knowing very little is great.
So do you find that's a commonality in all these places, that they were wanting to do improv, nothing was there, so they just grabbed some friends and said, hey, let's learn how to do this?
And I think now, I mean, we've been very lucky to hear stories of like groups in Mexico that are like, well, we didn't have anyone to teach us, so we would put a phone in the center of the room and we would put on your podcast, and that was our training. And so we would just listen and say, okay, let's do that thing, and get up on their feet and do it.
I think we insult each other now for an hour.
yeah.
Improv is being mean to your best friend.
And then talk about cobblestone and alcohol.
And then talk about a Greek myth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's kind of what's been so lovely about, I mean, looking at silver linings of the pandemic, when Zoom came around and we started doing workshops on Zoom, it's like, oh, we're teaching people from North America, from Lithuania, Australia, all at the same time. And people are like getting up at 2 a.m. to get up and do a class because now they have the ability to have access to all these people. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, you just kind of talked about giving each other a hard time. Has that always been like part of your chemistry on your podcast or?
Like our relationship, really. It's the basis of our relationship.
That's the basis of it.
Yeah.
It's very funny because I think that's just who we are and how we get along. But so then sometimes like newer improvisers will be like, I guess that's how you talk to other improvisers. Be like, hey, Rob, your mother sucks.
Like, Diane?
What?
She's a librarian. Leave
She's
her alone.
Great. What are
You're
you talking
a stranger.
About?
I don't know you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So looking back from that moment that you first thought comedy is what I want to do to where you are now, do you have moments that stand out as like, this is like the best moment that I've experienced as an improviser?
Whoa.
Mm.
Like on
I told
stage?
You I wanted to really get down into it.
Two come to mind for me. In Canada, we have this thing called the Canadian Improv Games, and it is the largest tournament in the country. 300 high school improv teams all have these regional tournaments, and you're trained by like your drama teacher and maybe a book, and you compete in these regions, and then the top five teams in the country get flown to Ottawa, and at the National Arts Center you do a sold out show doing improv when you're like 16. It was amazing. And there was one moment where I was like the new person. And we got this suggestion of like a monster truck rally. And that was the first time where I was like, I think I can take the lead on this. And I was the new kid. I was 16. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm at the National Arts Center. And I did it. And I was like, this is now what I want. And I didn't know before. I thought I dabbled in stand-up a little. But like that was the moment where I was like, oh, this is it. That's the thing I want to do. And then from there, it was all improv.
And I was in the audience that night, and I saw him play that monster truck and thought, that's it? I can do this. That's a really great question, Corey. Like, there's so many improv shows that they all kind of, like, they daisy chain together, and it's really hard to remember specific memories. But I do remember, I thought your story was going to involve me, but it didn't. I remember playing a show with you, and it was for the Canadian Comedy Awards. It was one of the early years when our troupe Mantown had been nominated, and we were performing in front of all the other nominees, which is like a nightmare. It's like people from all over Canada have come to like hang out and party, and like you're nominated, and you're going to perform in front of them. And I remember feeling really nervous and stressed out and judged. And then I this memory is me not remembering, like a blackout and a wave of just like laughter and joy. And then the show ended and I went, wow, that was great. And I have no recollection of what happened. I think I surfed on a surfboard.
Probably. And then you had you and our friend star of the podcast, Jason
Ross.
You were doing an MMA fight that turned into just like men who were like grappling and then just being a little softer with each other, then having a smooch.
Oh.
And that was the big physical bit of the show.
Oh, that's so funny. I'm so funny.
So the flip side of that now, which I hope will be just as funny, do you have a least favorite moment that stands out, like a total disaster?
These are easier. I once got hired when I was first starting to do a corporate show. Someone had seen me at Second City and with Jason DeRoss invited us to come perform for their Christmas party. I went, oh, this will be great. You get $200. You got to drive it to the suburbs. No problem. $400, two people. This will rock. When we get there, it's not at a bar or a restaurant. It's at the dealership. And we go, hey, cool, where's the stage? The guy goes, there's no stage. We go, cool, where's the microphone? There's no microphone. Where do you want us to do this? He goes, in front of the buffet. So, okay, we go, sure, we'll do this show for you. And is someone going to introduce us? No, just start doing it. By the way, no one knows you're here. I want it to be a surprise for them. So we just go to the middle of the floor, go, hey, everyone, we're here to do some improv. Who's here to do improv? I look around the room. There's a man in a suit trying to close a deal on a Subaru. He's still with a client. So we are doing improv games at someone else's Christmas party while a man's trying to sell a Subaru. I remember looking into Jason Zeroth's face and laughing so hard that I was having such a miserable time. I will never forget that show. Think of the best show you've ever done. I can't remember it. Think of the worst show. Easy. I got 100 of these.
Oh, my God.
I got 100 of these.
Well, after high school, after I got into the improv, there's a college in Toronto called the Humber College Comedy Writing and Performance Program. And it's great. Like, you learn stand-up, sketch, clown, all of this stuff. And so I was probably 2 months in. And an old high school teacher of mine was like, oh, my God, you're at Humber. That's amazing. It's like, yeah, I just did my first stand-up set. She's like, well, my daughter is getting married, and I think it would be great entertainment to have a stand-up comedian there.
Oh.
And we will pay you $200. And I was like, are you kidding me? Yes. Yes, absolutely yes. I hadn't done stand-up once, and she wanted 20 minutes of material. And so I was like, this is great. And I told my old improv coach from high school. And she was like, well, you have to say no. And I said, well, it's in 2 weeks. And she said, well, let's give it a shot. What do you got so far? And I said, nothing. And so anyway, long story short, got to the wedding. It was a Greek wedding. And so first off, it was a surprise. Anytime it's a surprise,
it's
no
Quit.
One wants comedy as a surprise.
No.
And so I got up to the microphone at this Greek wedding, and I was like, hey, everybody, I don't know. This was my first joke. So I had brought a paper plate. And so if you know anything about Greek celebrations, a lot of smashing
don't
of plates.
Don't finish it. Don't finish it.
And so I had the paper plate, and I went, hey, everyone, no, I'm not sure who paid for this wedding, but they really skimped out on the dishes.
No.
And then I tried to throw it and watch it go like this. And then I saw a whole bunch of tables all lean into the other people and then point at me and shake their head. Like, what's happening? Who is this man? And I talked for maybe 6 minutes, and then I could the adrenaline kicked in, my face got all red, and I said good night. And then I went to the table, and the person who hired me said, hey, I'm sorry, here's the money anyway. I felt like a superhero who showed up to an event and murdered all the good people. Like, I did not do my job, and I failed so hard. Yeah.
But you made money, so a lot of people would say that was successful.
Oh!
You made it!
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Professional. Yeah.
Reputation ruined. Like, I'm so glad social media wasn't around at the time, because I would have been destroyed. But that $200 got me home.
Nice. Now, we've been focusing on performing, but you both have also taught and coached as well?
Yes.
So do you have favorite moments from that, from your experiences teaching and coaching?
Yeah.
Or is that too hard?
No, it's just so many stories. So many. Where I'm like, I can't say it. I can't even get specific about it, but I've had awful moments. Now I'm trying to think of even worse moments.
Oh, good moments with teaching, though.
Is that what the question is?
Yeah.
Good moments.
Or if it's not a moment that you can think of specifically, just something like what...
Oh, like a
what
win.
What do you
a
like
coaching
about
win.
It? Like, what do you get out of teaching that you think you don't get from performing? How about that?
I'm a very binary thinker when it comes to improv. Like, I'm very much like, this equals this. So if I can teach someone that, that's the way I teach. I like clear instruction, clear feedback. And so anytime there's a moment where I can see it click, when someone goes from, I don't get it, let me try this. Let me try this. Is this what I'm supposed to be doing? And then they do it and it clicks. That moment for me is like, I've just given you a tool to add to your Batman utility belt for life. And that for me, empowering someone, as cheesy as that sounds, empowering someone to say, hey, now you're a little less afraid to get up in front of a bunch of people and make things up. That for me is the win. I love that.
Yeah. And I think like a big part of this is also you want to give the thing that you didn't have when you were coming up. So you're like, oh, I wish I had a teacher that did X for me. I wish I had a teacher that like learned my name in the first week and cared that I did well. And you're like, cool, I'm going to try and be that teacher. And you don't always master that. But, oh, can I explain this very complicated thing to you? You know, for a while in Toronto, we had this big challenge where no one, long form was so new in Toronto that the only people who knew what Game of the Scene was the people who were trying to learn Game of the Scene.
And I thought for the longest time, Game of the Scene meant yell louder than your partner. Every time, whatever they say, you go louder. And that's heightening.
Yeah. So heightening equals volume.
Yes, that was what I thought, because no one told me different.
And I still don't have the heart to tell them what it is. and so like we were in a situation where the students were kind of like the people who were on the forefront of improv, what was happening in improv. And so you're like, oh, well, I can be the person now to explain to you what Game of the Scene is because I understand it, and hopefully I can explain it in a clear, easy way. So that's satisfying.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's are things that after people have completed their training, not that they ever stop learning, but completed like their training and they get more experience performing, do you think there are things that people tend to forget, if that makes sense, like basics that people have to consciously return to that they may have left out?
Because I
would say that, during the pandemic, for me and for a lot of people, there was a lot of time that passed. So, you know, you come back feeling a little bit rusty. But sometimes even when you're performing constantly, you, at least I think you might be able to get so wrapped up in your performance that you forget about some of the basics. Do you agree that that's...
I think yes. I think what you're saying, absolutely yes, you can forget about some of the basics. But also I think Adam and I, we've talked about this a lot in the podcast, there are some things that you learn maybe in a level one that are the booster rockets of improv that you use to get you out into the atmosphere. And then once you're gone, you can kind of leave them behind. Like one example of that for us would probably be don't ask questions. Which is like, that's a good thing to learn in level one. But like Adam and I, when we perform together, I'm not thinking, oh, whoops, I asked a question. The show is ruined. I don't care. Ask questions whatever I want. If I'm curious about your character, I'm going to ask you a question. So those kinds of basics for me, I think, oh, you could probably leave them behind if you're doing something more complicated. But I think the basics that I think you're most likely to lose, at least in Toronto, is just vulnerability. So the machine of our city are jams, improv jams. And improv jams, basically the way they work is you show up with a bunch of strangers. There's probably an artistic director somewhere hovering around at the bar. And the way you move forward in our city is you do really well at those jams. And people go, wow, that one person in the group of people is very, very funny. So you have a bunch of people rushing for jokes, doing very big characters. And in that circumstance where everyone's trying to be the biggest, the funniest, it really doesn't make sense for you to open your heart to those people, right, in that context, because there is no reward for that vulnerability. So over time, you can get into a situation where you close up a lot and you're just doing a bunch of jokes, you're doing a bunch of big characters. And so that's something I think everyone can kind of come back to. Find someone that you trust, find a show that you care about, and really just try and feel something on stage.
Yeah, I think the idea of getting to a certain level and then maintaining that is so hard. And so the idea of, well, I'm not going to be vulnerable, or I'm not going to listen to someone else because I don't have time for you, I need to do my thing so I can maintain. I'm good, everyone. You see it? I'm good. Whatever you have to bring to me, I can't afford to risk this being a bad scene, right? Toronto has quite a few teams, but a lot of individuals. And so when you're an individual star, it's a lot of, I need to maintain what I've built, and that can come at the expense of other people.
So how do you think you maintain that balance between like what you feel like you want to be able to do as a performer, but also keeping in mind you are not the only person on stage?
I think when you get to a certain place, it's like you have to, obviously you like to perform as much as possible, but you kind of have to adjust your expectations and expectations of yourself per show. And so when you start to perform with, when you get to a certain level and you're like, I kind of only want to perform with these people to do the kinds of work I like to do. And that work is for those shows. And then you are free to say, I'm going to do any other show and I'm open to any other style. And that balance, I think, keeps you a very well-rounded performer of still doing shows that maybe you have no control over, that you have no stake in. If it's the worst show you've ever done, nothing matters. And then you can do a show like when Rob and I would perform to be like, well, we have expectations for ourselves. We have challenges for ourselves. We have ways that we want to get better as a group, and we have common goals. And so I think those balances really help out. Because if you ignore the shows that maybe you feel are less than, you're really cutting yourself off from any kind of risk or growth.
Yeah, I think it's a really good point, Adam.
Thanks, man. Okay. So, Corey, what do you got next?
Oh, my gosh. But if you think about, do you ever have a skateboarding friend? Do you ever have a skateboarding friend, Corey? Someone who's a skateboarder?
I do not know anybody.
Things will pick up, Corey. You'll find one.
You'll find a skateboarding friend.
All right.
So if you're a skateboarder, this is what you do. You and maybe another buddy, or maybe by yourself, you take your skateboard and you go out and you practice your tricks and you videotape it. At the end of the day, you come home to your partner, your wife, your husband, and you go, hey, today I got a 180 kickflip. Today I got a dark slide. Whatever it is, you got this skateboarding trick. And it's all about this kind of stunt that you're trying to do. There's no one there to watch you do this skateboarding trick. No one's going to watch the video of you doing it. You're just kind of collecting the experience for yourself. And when I think about improv, I think that's also what we should be doing, which is like tonight, there are 10 people in the audience or whatever, or this is a weird show that I'm playing. Well, you can still collect something for yourself. Oh, you know what? I'm going to play guilt. I'm going to see if I can feel guilty on stage tonight. You can collect that experience regardless of if there's an audience, if you're performing in front of a car dealership, wherever, you can figure that out. So I think that's a nice way to get our validation internally as opposed to how many laughs can I get from these strangers.
Okay, now that you brought up details about skateboarding, here's a question. So outside of comedy, what do you feel like you're so knowledgeable about that you're an expert? Because it really is fun in scenes to be able to tell true things and kind of show off how smart you are. So do you have something like that, like, aside from comedy, this is like your area of expertise?
Mine would be hockey. I'm a big sports boy, and I like the amount of joy I get from the Toronto Maple Leafs is shocking. Absolutely shocking. When I can't sleep, I picture the lineup and picture different configurations and like free agents that might be available and salary cap implications. So I love the Toronto Maple Leafs and I love hockey. So that's probably the first thing that comes to mind of like, what can I talk about for hours? That.
For me, it would be modern art after 1950. Greek mythology. Norse mythology, Mesopotamian mythology, which no one ever talks to me about.
He said one thing. He said one thing.
Oh, sorry.
What's one thing?
I do recall you talking about Mesopotamian. You say art, history, both? I know I've heard that before on one of your shows.
I'm very interested in that time period. Today we went to the Dallas Art Museum, and we were looking for a very tiny statue of Gilgamesh, and no one could find it. And so I dragged Adam all across this museum to find Gilgamesh.
We got curators of the museum being like, I don't know where the Gilgamesh, come with me. And we were like on the hunt with them. It was incredible.
So we found it. And once we finally found it, I was like, oh, there it is. And the security guard wanted to know where it was for when the next creep comes to the museum looking for this strange statue. So I was like, oh, there it is. And then there's this woman and her two children, and they go, what's that? I go, oh, it's a statue of Gilgamesh. And she goes, who's that? Will you tell me who it is? And I looked to Adam and I was like, it's time. I've waited my entire life. Yes, do you know who Enkidu is? No? Let's begin. Very good. Very satisfying day today.
Amazing. So we've talked a lot about kind of the mechanics of improv and performing and gone deep into a few areas, but I still want to ask some fun goofball questions. So if you could insert yourself into any television show or movie in history, what would you choose?
Oh, I want to do Adams right now. What's that game where it's like the newlywed game where you both show the card?
Yeah, like I would say for you and you would say for me?
Yeah.
Is that what we want to do?
Sure, okay.
I like that.
So wait, I've got to say what I think you would insert yourself into.
Yeah, what show?
Okay, I got it.
Here, are you ready?
Yeah. One, two, three. Seinfeld. Star Trek.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent.
That's all.
So why Star Trek?
TNG.
The next generation.
TNG, for sure.
Wow. Oh, okay. I'm so honored that you knew that.
Earl Grey, hot.
Wow.
Amazing.
Yeah, right. Rob and I actually, like, quite a healthy relationship of... going after, like, today was the, what? Oh, okay. I was just holding my hand. But, yeah, I think that's one of the real benefits of the relationship, and I think any improv relationship, of getting on stage and being, like, when I can see the glint in Rob's eye, and I literally will know I don't have to do anything for the next few minutes. Rob has this, and he's got something up his sleeve. And Rob knows when he looks at me and I get a little like smirk or like do a little something with my lips, Rob knows, oh, Adam's going to do something fucking stupid. Here we go. But it helps us so much on stage. And I think it's just such a lovely thing to have with improvisers of you joke and you hang out. And that's all improv is really, right? You're hanging out together. And so to be able to look at each other and be like, I know what's up with that guy's brain is very cool.
It is very cool.
Okay, so what about Adam? What would he pick?
He would pick Seinfeld, which is his favorite show of all time. I would say if you talk to Adam for a long period of time, you will hear maybe between 20 and 100 quotes from Seinfeld in a conversation, nonstop.
Yeah, and some you don't even pick up on, which is disappointing, because I'm like, this. If someone was here, this is the most timed thing possible. But you're not into comedies.
Yeah, Adam will look at me and be like, now I got the mail. I'm like, I don't know what that means. So it a joke from Seinfeld? I think that was a transactional moment. Anyways.
So if you made a comment about Junior Mints, it would be totally lost.
No, I love Seinfeld. Oh. I know Junior Mints. we were trying to figure out what was the name of the baseball player that spit on
Keith Hernandez.
It was Keith Hernandez. Yeah, he knew it.
Easy.
All right. Now I just want to hear like top Seinfeld.
Oh, my God. I mean, I'll tell you. The thing that gets me, and I literally show improv students this, George being a marine biologist, and he does this whole speech about getting on top of the whale, and it all connects, right? It's such a perfect ending to a Harold where it all connects. And when George pulls out the golf ball and shows what was causing the blockage, and it's Kramer's golf ball, there is one woman in the live studio audience who gets it before everybody else. And she doesn't laugh, she screams. Because her brain can't comprehend that everything she's watched for the last 22 minutes all connects into this one perfect visual gag. And her first reaction is not even laughter. It's just, ah! And then everybody else laughs. And I'm telling you, go look it up.
I'm going to have to go watch that again.
One woman, and that for me is like what makes Seinfeld so not just funny, but satisfying.
It's a magic trick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it really is. The Herald itself is, you know, when done really well. And I heard I have heard people make that comparison a lot with Seinfeld. And I was going to ask if you agree, but clearly you do. All right. So, new question. Superpower. Any superpower, what would it be?
Like a superhero superpower?
Yeah. Well, anything. It's improv. You can say anything you want, right?
The first thing that comes to mind is like the power to go back in time.
Do you want to fix things?
No, I want to either experience things that you can, like, I was talking to Rob about, like, we were almost going to go to the Dallas Heritage Village, which is like a pioneer village of Dallas.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just didn't have time for it, but I was like, I just want to walk and, like, pretend I'm there, and I want to, like, touch the wood, and I want to look at, like, how people lived and imagine myself there. So I just have a huge nostalgia feeling of, like, oh, I would love to have been there at that time. So that's the first thing that comes to my mind.
That's wrong.
Wait a second.
You pick magic.
Magic as a power?
Yeah, magic. Because then you can cast that time backwards in time spell. Magic is all the powers.
Or if he would just insert himself into Star Trek, The Next Generation, he could just go to the holodeck.
Yeah. But, like, let's be honest. You're going to go to the holodeck. It's going to come to life again and kill you. So there's really no point, you know?
All right.
One person
just
gets that.
One Star Trek fan.
If you could choose a song that would play every time you enter a room, well, what would that be?
I think we've chosen it, haven't we?
Would it be your theme song?
We also have a song that we play before every show, which is The Pursuit of Happiness by Kid Cudi, the Steve Aoki remix. And that we played that for every performance we've ever done. And when that drop happens, it is just I think it fills everybody with excitement, and it gets our hearts pumping.
And when you say everybody, you mean us too. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody else is indifferent, but it happens to be the song.
We've classically conditioned ourselves to like this song. It's not like we're like Kid Cudi fans or like I don't know any other. I know he has that song about day and night.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So it's clear that I'm not a massive Kid Cudi fan, but because we picked this random song at the beginning of this project, now I have a very deep relationship with this song. I've heard it in 7 or 8 countries before in an improv show. All it's right. A very good song.
If you had to choose today the title of your autobiography or the Netflix special about your life, what would that be?
These are deep. They sound like jokes, but they're deep.
Yeah, the fun questions are still deep, apparently. So,
okay, mine will be having a time. That for me is like that having a time is that vibe of like we've all agreed we're gonna make the best of this situation, and I really get into the idea of like, hey, we're doing this. Let's have a time. That's mine. Having a time.
Having a time. Yeah. All right.
The name of my autobiography would be called You Did It. And then the subtitle is You Tricked Everyone to Letting You Be Here Even Though You Don't Deserve to Be. That would be my autobiography.
Wow. Cool.
Great.
Wow.
All right. You make a lot of recommendations on your podcast, particularly toward the end. I'd be interested to know what are three things, I'm going to say works of art, but anything, book, movie, TV show, or artwork itself. What would you recommend to students that are studying improv to, like, help them along?
So you mean not improv related that would inspire them?
It could be anything.
Okay.
I've been answering first every time.
Yeah, that's our relationship.
Okay, so these are three. Book, what did you say? Book?
Anything. Book, movie, TV show.
Oh, man.
Something you would point to and say, you really need to check this out.
I mean, Adam, you're going to be much better at this question than I am because you actually do this. You go, hey, I'm really excited about this thing. You got to check this out. But in real life, I don't think I ever recommend anything to anyone because I just assume no one is interested in the same things that I am. But if there's things that you would recommend.
Like, I do think Seinfeld is a great tool to see how you take a situation and you heighten it to the next level. And then you find a way to connect it to the other stories, right? And we talk about long form where Harold's going, the idea of why it's such a magic trick is we're going from random, completely random, mm-hmm. to connected. And it's like, how did you do that? And for me, watching Seinfeld, it's like, oh, how can you pick up on all of the nuances, or at least be aware of the nuances, so that you can look for nuances in the B storyline and find out what are the unmet needs or what are the wants of certain characters, and how can we combine someone's needs with someone's wants and see if we can put those together. So Seinfeld for me is a clear one for long-form improv.
Yeah, I mean, if I were thinking about something to recommend, I would say like Days and Nights of the Second City was really helpful for me because it kind of gave a context to what we're doing and where improv kind of comes from. It gives a really good history of how Second City came to be. I know there's a bunch of improv history books. I wish someone would write a new one that kind of talks about all of the history of improv. Our history is really interesting and it's really weird, and the things that we do are inherently political and have a history of politics to it, which I don't think many people entering into a 101 class know about. And so, I mean, I guess I'm recommending a book that doesn't exist yet.
But you've written a book, and you have done a podcast episode dedicated to the history of improv. So sounds like the pieces are there, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
When's that book going to come out?
The first book took 7 years to write.
Oh,
it's like 150 pages. So in 35 years, you will have a 200-page book on the history
right.
of improv.
All right. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
Stay tuned to our website.
Okay. Now we're going to move to first thought, best thought. So I'm going to ask you some questions. And what I'm going after are one word answers, like whatever comes to your mind
fun.
First.
And for equity, I will answer first in this game.
Great.
In one word, what is your idea of misery?
Stomach pain.
Grief.
Mm-hmm.
In one word, what is your idea of pure bliss?
Back rub in a pool.
One word.
It's one idea.
Back rub pool. giggles.
Okay. In one word, what or who is your biggest inspiration?
In one word.
One word.
We're going to say, like, Jeff.
One word, biggest inspiration.
Rob.
Adam.
Yeah.
All right. Perfect. In one word, what is your biggest vice?
Coziness.
Alcohol.
Okay.
It's a better one.
Do you ask for permission or forgiveness?
Forgiveness.
Forgiveness.
Excellent. What one word best describes you and your brand of comedy?
Talking. Explaining.
I think silly. Yeah.
Faces for you.
Faces. I love faces.
Face-based comedy.
Is that your thing?
I don't think so. Is it?
You do faces.
Oh, I do faces.
I'm curious.
Maybe more of the Adam Colleague thing is paper plate at a Greek wedding.
No, I don't know if this is from Drag Race, but the idea of taking your silliness seriously. And so I think that is my vibe of, like, how can I convince you that this silly thing is deadly serious? That's what I really enjoy.
Yeah.
We talked a little bit backstage about getting some questions from the audience, and we have some time. I would like to hear from the audience a question that you have for Rob and Adam. And since it is a podcast, I guess repeat the question.
Sure, yeah, we can do that. Yeah. How many people on stage is too many people on stage? I mean, I guess it depends what show you're doing. I would say like 10 is up there.
I mean, it's pretty classic idea of like not having more people on stage than in the audience. Because if you had a show of 10 people and there's three people in the audience, I would cut that show in half and say, five, go in the audience and do a five-person set and then switch.
I will say this. Back in the days of the Second City long-form program, we were working on this format called The Maker. And The Maker is all about rewriting the rules of improv on the spot. It's a very complicated, weird form. And for whatever reason, we decided that having a stage and an audience was inequitable, and we wanted pure equality in the room. So all of the audience was brought up on stage, and everyone was allowed to perform. And it was the worst improv show I've ever seen. But one hell of a time.
What a time.
A fun thing to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah, what a mess we made.
Huh. Anybody else?
Adam, what's the format you enjoy the most? Laurent?
we were just burning Laurent earlier. No, the Armando. I think the Armando is unique because it's the melding of stand-up and improv. And it's really the only time where you get an insight into who the improvisers are. Because normally it's like, hey, we're the Giggle Hut. We're going to do a form for you. And you just do a bunch of characters. See ya. And you don't get to meet anyone. But in an Armando, you're like, I'm going to tell you a real-life monologue that's true and could be completely unfunny and maybe very sad. And it gives the audience a chance to have a break from comedy and get to know the people who are actually performing for you. So for me, it satisfies a bunch of the things that I enjoy about being on stage all in one show.
Yeah, Armando is a very good pick. For me, I think it would be no form with people who have done lots of formats. So, like, playing a Herald is fine. I enjoy doing it. But my preference would be to do an open format with people who could, on the spot, create a Herald or drop into an Armando or drop into something else if we needed to. That's where it gets really exciting for me, where you're not really sure where we're going. That structure's kind of being revealed to you as you go.
I think improv has a very big marketing problem. And because improv and classes for improv coexist and have a symbiotic relationship. And so it's like, anyone can do it. Sign up for classes. And then there's no reason why those people in their first day of class can't put up a show that night and just say, improv, it's the best improvisers in the country are here. And no one can say they are or they aren't. Because who's the judge of that? So a lot of people are seeing a lot of bad improv and saying, oh, that's improv. Where improv doesn't have the equivalent of an open mic night. And it feels like, unless you're at a certain level, you should probably brand your improv show as, we're up and coming. We're learning. Or this is the improv open mic. So if people started to be like, oh, no, I'm going to an improv show, you're going to see a good show. Versus you're seeing people who are learning how to do shows, and it's you're basically watching a class versus a show. And I think we need to figure out how we can market it as such. And I don't think anyone has really figured that out yet, unless you're a large scale corporate theater like the Second City, where it's like, we have six performers that this is their full-time job. And they work for months on this show. And when you come to see it, you're paying $35, $40, but you're guaranteed a good show. Yeah, but again, there's no reason why the people in the jam can't be like, we are now called the Frankensteiners. And we rented a theater, and we put out posters and Facebook messages and said, come see our show. Well, anyone who sees that show is probably going to have a bad time. And they're going to say, I saw an improv show last night. Improv sucks. I'm never going to see improv again. But if you brand it as, come see this exciting new troupe who's trying something brand new. It's experimental. We don't know what's going to happen. Okay. Then we get a bit more forgiveness. But I think young improvisers are still on the hunt for audiences, so they're going to say whatever you can to get a crowd. And I get it. We did it. But I think now, as we have more access to marketing, we should just figure out a better way to say, you're guaranteed a good time, probably a good time, you're here to support your friends.
And that might be a specific to like a Toronto scene thing. There's a lot of posters that if you go into Comedy Bar, you'll be like, the best improvisers of all time, the best improvisers of all time. It's like, we might need a new way to market this. I think there's also this other issue. When you talk about sketch and you talk about stand-up, there's a kind of refinement that happens there over and over and over again. You're doing the same material. So it's like, if you were to go to Second City, which Adam and I both worked at, both understudied at, it's really weird watching a main stage performer do their sketch on a Tuesday night because they pause for laughs that happen on Friday and Saturday. And they don't happen on Tuesday because there's 30 people in the audience. So they know when the laughs are supposed to come. Stand-up is the exact same thing. It's like a wizard casting a spell. The wording has to be perfect. In improv, we can't do that. It is kind of inherently rough around the edges. Now, a lot of people have tried to refine improv and take out lots of the chaos, but as you refine improv and make it less dangerous, we lose some of the energy in it. And then it starts to feel a little bit stuffy. Something's off about it. So if there is a way to maintain the chaos of what improv is and then also refine that, I think that would be the big question. And specifically when we're thinking about moving forward, specifically about televising improv, Whose Line has done it? Middleditch and Schwartz have come pretty close. But creating improv specials is a very hard thing to do. Because how do you translate that roughness onto a medium like television? It flattens everything, and it just feels like a laissez-faire sketch. And we don't want our improv to feel like that. You want it to feel alive and dangerous, and that's the reason why people come see improv.
I have kind of wondered about specials like that and how they appeal to audiences, because I can't watch those as a non-improviser. That's impossible, right? But I see things like Middleditch and Schwartz, and I think they did that really well. Because I agree, a lot of times, especially if it's video, if you see a video of something that your troupe did, it does come across as like very flat. Of course, you don't have, you know, a professional cameraman or sound guy or anything like that. But yeah,
it's yeah, Adam especially. I know people probably want to get to drinking. Is there any other final questions before we head off into the night?
Yeah, we got one.
Okay. Okay.
Sorry, I know we want to get to drinking. Do we have any best practices for performing in a show that has like a rotating cast, guests, that sort of thing? And then the second question would be, would you like to participate in one at 9 o'clock?
So question, what do you do with a show that's rotating with your cast?
Yes. So for me, this was, it's a great question because I feel like there's such... improvisers can be inherently lazy, and the idea of let's just have fun, that's the very easy answer. But I think a simple solution is having the chat of what is our goal tonight, and get it all, as long as everyone's on the same page, that's the best thing we can hope for. And so if we all get backstage and we're like, okay, what is the goal tonight? And usually if it's the person who booked the space or the coach or the leader, they'll maybe give some ideas of like, could we focus on this or that? But just making sure that everybody's on the same page and working towards the same thing. Because there's nothing worse than I come into a show and it's like, I'm going to play really grounded and soft tonight. I'm going to listen and really connect. And Rob thinks we're doing a bar prov show and he's running through the audience, drinking people's drinks. Rob's not doing anything wrong, but I'd be very mad because he betrayed what I wanted. And it's not fair to assume everybody wants the same thing. So I think just collectively saying, hey, everyone, here's the goal tonight, so let's work towards that, I think really helps remove blame and any kind of animosity between players.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think shared mental model is the answer. So in Toronto, I'm part of this team called Strike, and what we do is a very large cast of more than 12 people, and every month we do a show where we get together in 15 minutes before the show. We try and improvise a long form format as complicated as the Herald. We've never done that form before. We never rehearsed it. We have an idea and we go, yeah, let's try that tonight. Those shows are really fun for me to do, and actually they end up being pretty great. But it's a very ambitious show, and there's a cast kind of coming and going. Well, it's easy for us to do because we've been working together for 10 years in different shows and different troupes. So if someone's missing or someone joins, it doesn't feel like, who are you? What do you do? So getting to know each other, having that familiarity is really going to help a lot. And then, yeah, you can totally do whatever you want. Yeah.
And, yeah, I'm down to play.
Yeah, we'll play. Sure.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Good question.
Okay, great.
Guys, thank you so much for your time. If people want to find out more about the Backline podcast or either of you personally, where do they go?
Yeah, so you can go to our website is www.youtube.com/bingobongoimprovtime. You can also find us at the Backline Pod on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram.
Yep.
And that's where you can find us.
Great. For our listeners, don't forget to check out dallas-comedyclub.com for our current show calendar and dallascomedyclubtrainingcenter.com for all of our current classes. Thank you again to all of our listeners for tuning in. I've been your host, Corey Whaley, sitting in for Kimberly Alou, but you already knew that.
And sorry, can we give it up for Corey?
Who's what a great job. Great hosting.
My pleasure. I was looking forward to this. It's a dream come true. All right. Stay safe out there, folks. Thank you.